All right, this will be the eighth commandment, excuse me, the eighth commandment, part 11, thou shalt not steal, based, of course, upon Exodus chapter 20 and verse 15, and Deuteronomy 5:19, and, of course, all of the eighth commandment statutes found throughout the Pentateuch and elaborated upon throughout the entire Bible, Old and New Testament alike. We've seen that, of course, that thou shalt not steal has not been done away with because the law has not been done away with and stealing has not been done away with. You know, I think God has in mind to keep his commandment, thou shalt not steal, as long as there's thieves around and that need to be dealt with, or people that might have an inclination towards stealing if he didn't have that commandment. And so, of course, we find that commandment in the New Testament and certain statutes that are dealt with by the writers of the New Testament that sometimes aren't recognized as related to actual statutes of the Old Covenant Ten Commandments until you really start digging and putting them together. In the previous message, we were examining the Eighth Commandment statute found in Deuteronomy chapter 19 and verse 14 that declares that, quote, that thou shalt not remove thy neighbor's landmark, which they of old time have set in thine inheritance, which thou shalt inherit in the land that Yahweh thy God giveth thee to possess it. Now, I discussed this statute, and I think last message probably was a little bit disjointed. I probably didn't do the best job of clarifying why I was going to some of the dealing with some of the things I dealt with. But essentially, in the last message, I discussed this particular statute from a personal, from a corporate, and a government level or perspective. And I left off, if you remember in the last message, in the middle of a discussion concerning how this statute also is nationally transgressed. We look at it personally, corporate, governmentally, and then in the last message I left off how this statute is transgressed from a national perspective via specifically integration and miscegenation. We left off, or we concluded last week's message following a reading from Ezra chapter 9, if you remember, verse 1 through chapter 10 and verse 3, a passage that relates Ezra's grave concern for the fact that at that time, Israel, specifically Judah, had not only been integrated with other non-Israelite nations, but also with the fact that she had also unlawfully mixed with, or intermarried with, as some people might call it, with non-Israelite peoples. Now, we won't go back and read all of this again, but let's go back and refresh our minds at least with a portion of these two chapters. So if you'll turn to Ezra chapter 9, Ezra chapter 9, and again, just to refresh our memories, starting with verse 1. Let me take a drink of water again here. Ezra chapter 9, and beginning with verse 1, it says, "And now when these things were done, the princes came to me, saying, the people of Israel and the priests and the Levites have not separated themselves from the people of the lands, doing according to their abominations, even of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Egyptians, and the Amorites." And of course, those were the people in the land at that time, so that's who he's dealing with. Verse 2, "For they have taken of their daughters..." By the way, you might also note that it doesn't mention the Midianites and some of the other peoples of the land with which Israel could mix, with which Israelite men could take the women of those nations of the same race who were also a part in the land then that they had mixed with, but they're not mentioned because they were lawful for them to partake. Notice there were those that were lawful and those that were unlawful. By the way, we'll deal with this more as we go through this, but these people, these Amorites and these Canaanites and these Moabites and Ammonites and so forth, were they idolaters? Indeed they were. Were the Midianites also idolaters and some of the other nations that were there present that aren't mentioned in this passage? Yeah, they were idolaters as well, weren't they? In fact, Israel themselves often were idolaters. You'll see the point of that, I think, as we get further into this. Verse 2, "For they," after mentioning these different nations, it says, "For they have taken of their daughters for themselves, and for their sons so that the holy seed have mingled themselves with the peoples, the people of those lands. Yea, the hand of the princes and the rulers have been chief in this trespass. Jump down to verse 10. And now, O our God, what shall we say after this? For we have forsaken thy commandments. Again, he's particularly dealing with this situation, not all the commandments, but in particular this one. Which thou hast commanded by thy servants the prophets, saying, the land unto which you go to possess it is an unclean land with the filthiness of the peoples of the lands, with their abominations, which have filled it from one end to another with their uncleanness. Now therefore, give not your daughters unto their sons, neither take their daughters unto your sons, nor seek their peace or their wealth forever, that you may be strong and eat the good of the land and leave it for an inheritance to your children forever. Jump down to verse 14. Should we again break thy commandments and join in affinity with the people of these abominations? Wouldest not thou be angry with us till thou hast consumed us, so that there should be no remnant or nor escaping? Verse 15, Yahweh God of Israel, thou art righteous, for we remain yet escaped as it is this day. Behold, we are before thee in our trespasses, for we cannot stand before you because of this. And then jump down to chapter 10, verse 2 and 3. And Shechaniah, the son of Jael, one of the sons of Elam, answered and said unto Ezra, we have trespassed against our God and have taken strange wives of the people of the land, yet now there is hope in Israel concerning this thing. Why would there be hope in Israel? Verse 3. Now therefore, let us make a covenant with our God to put away all the wives and such as are born of them, according to the counsel of my Lord and of those that tremble at the commandment of our God, and let it be done according to the law. And so there, I mean, we see again, and let me emphasize how Ezra's grave concern for this, and again, if you remember some of the other portions that we read, how he laid himself out before God in prayer, devastated with the whole idea that the people had gone and done this. I mean, pulled out his own hair out of his head and his beard. And again, I point out that I like Nehemiah's boy better, because you go read his account about this same situation, and he went and pulled out the hair off the heads of those who were guilty instead. And for some, I'm losing hair fast enough. I don't need to be pulling out my hair. But both of them, there's no question, they were grievously burdened with this transgression of Yahweh's law in this regard. Now, nearly every Christian church today will tell you that that was all happened, and it was strictly or solely for religious reasons, that these people were idolaters, and God didn't want them to get mixed up in idolatry. Well, we'll see that that was not the case. However, even if it was, I want you to think about this. Is there, first, let me ask you a question. Is there anything new under the sun? In other words, is it any different today than it was then? Even if that was the only reason. Does not Israel today have the same proclivities that Israel of old had then? Of course, the answer is yes. There is nothing new under the sun. In other words, if integration and miscegenation led people away from the true worship of Yahweh then, do you really think that people have changed and it's any different today? You know, that's what hardly anybody ever deals with that. Even if that's all the only reason that Ezra was concerned about this mixing with other peoples, nothing's changed. In fact, one only has to look at modern America, and it's obvious that nothing's changed in this regard. Because the more integrated and multicultural we have become, which is, you know, that's the thing today. We want to be, you know, let's go get integrated. Let's get multicultural. That's the thing to do today. So everybody's promoting it, but nobody's looking at the result of it from a religious standpoint. Christians, non-Christians, and Christians alike. Because the more integrated and the more multicultural we have become, the more America, talking about America, modern Israel, at least this part of modern Israel found here in America, it was pretty much predominantly all Israel at one point. Over the last 200 some years, and especially over the last 50 years, we have become more and more integrated, more and more pluralistic. And what's happened? We have become, therefore, less Christian as a nation. Now, that is a fact that no one can challenge. And therefore, nothing's changed. And so even if that was, if religion was the only concern of Ezra, Nehemiah, and the others at leaders of that at that time, it's still the same problem today, and America proves it. And therefore, for that reason alone, integration, miscegenation should still be just as much a concern today for us as it was in Ezra's day. However, religion is only one of the reasons, and this is so often, almost nearly always missed, that religion is only one of the reasons to be concerned about integration and miscegenation. However, before getting to the other reasons stated by Ezra, it should be noted first that neither Ezra nor Nehemiah or anyone else provided for any exceptions. In other words, they made no exceptions in saying that, you know, hey, we've got to deal with this. And we've got to take extreme measures to the point of sending these wives from these foreign nations and their children away. That in doing that, they made no exceptions for any foreign wives who had converted to Yahweh. Now, do you suspect that some of the wives had? Maybe none had. But I suspect they had, or at least put on the semblance. I'll guarantee about that time there would have been a whole lot of conversions. They're going to say, hey, I'm converting over. Don't send me away. If there had been an exception here. But there were no exceptions made for the non-Israelite wives who had converted to Yahweh. Or for the children who had been born from these mixed relationships, who might be converted later had they been left with their fathers. Ezra and Nehemiah's instructions to separate were all inclusive with no exceptions whatsoever, which makes this point alone the Achilles heel, if you will, for those who want to make these instructions only a matter of religion. Even if it was, again, only a matter of religion, God made no exceptions. It obviously wasn't just a matter of religion, because there are no exceptions made for any wife or child in those mixed relationships who had converted to Yahweh to remain there with Israel. Ezra, however, provided two other reasons why the Israelites were commanded to separate from the other nations listed in chapter 9. And you say, well, what does all this have to do with the Eighth Commandment? Well, we're getting there, so hang on. But we want to deal with all of this. Ezra, let's look at Ezra chapter 9 and verse 2. He provides two other reasons. Here's the next one. Ezra 9:2, it says, they, speaking of the Judahites, have taken of their non-Israelite daughters for themselves and for their sons, so that the holy seed, and who's he speaking of there? Israel, of course. Israel was considered the holy seed. In fact, the New American Standard says the holy race. And he says, let me start again. They have taken of their daughters for themselves and for their sons, so that the holy seed or race have mingled themselves with the people of the land, of those lands. In other words, this practice was condemned by Ezra not only because it polluted the religion of the Israelites, but also because it polluted, or if you prefer, it's the same thing, adulterated the race or the genes of the Israelites. So there's a second reason, not just for religious purposes, but also because it had mingled the holy race of Israel, as stated by Ezra in Ezra 9:2. That word mingled, by the way, is an interesting word. It's Strong's number 6148, if you want to look it up yourself. It's the Hebrew word Arab. A-R-A-B, it looks like Arab, Arab, and it means to braid, or that is, intermix, technically to traffic. And then, as if by barter, it says, listen to this, also to give, to be security as a kind of exchange, end of quote. Proverbs, where it talks about going surety, where God says, don't do it. It's the same word there that's here used to talk about the mingling of Israel's seed. And what was it that was being, if you will, if you want to look at it from a surety standpoint, by taking advantage of, if you want to put it in those terms, of the other people's forbidden lineages that were up, in the land that day. And thus, by taking women from those nations and taking them as wives and bearing children from them, think about it from the surety standpoint. What was it that was they were doing that they were giving as surety in order to partake of this sin? Well, how about the land of their inheritance? They were going surety. They were putting up the land as barter, if you will, for the sake of mixing with these people. Which brings us to the next reason provided by Ezra, and again, one that's almost totally missed. Verse 12 provides us the third reason why the Israelites were commanded to separate from their foreign wives and children, and which brings us now back to the eighth commandment, and particularly the statute in Deuteronomy 19:14 that you're not to move the landmarks. Here it is, verse 12, if you want to read it with me. It says, "Give not your daughters unto their sons, neither take their daughters unto your sons, nor seek their peace, nor their wealth forever." And then he gives the reason, "that ye may be strong and eat the good of the land and leave it for an inheritance to your children forever." In other words, if these mixed marriages had been allowed to continue, the land inheritance would have been in jeopardy of being lost or turned over. The boundary markers, Deuteronomy 19:14, we're going back to this in a much greater way than just somebody's individual land. Now we're talking Israel nationally, from a national perspective, that because of integration and segregation, the boundary markers would have been overturned, would have been lost altogether to a mixed multitude born of these mixed marriages. And keep in mind that that would have occurred even if both parents of these mixed children, that would have happened, that still would have happened, even if the both parents of these mixed children, or the mixed children themselves for that matter, were believers in Yahweh. It still would have happened. Israel would have lost her inheritance. The boundary markers would have been removed. Israel would have still been dispossessed, even if the wives had converted to Yahweh, or the children had converted to Yahweh. Israel's land would, or Israel would have still been dispossessed of her land, and the boundaries would have been removed. And don't forget that according to Yahweh's laws, land grants were to always remain in the hands or in the control and power and possession of the family of the original Israelite owners. Not somebody else. It wasn't even be passed on from tribe to tribe, let alone to a non-Israelite nation. And thus Ezra was... Well, let me back up. Except for, of course, farmlands that could be leased. However, of course, they had to be, according to the law of Jubilee, they had to be returned to the original land owners every 50th year. And therefore, integration and miscegenation would have been a threat to these policies or these laws. And Ezra understood it. And therefore, he not only deals with miscegenation or unlawful mixing with other nations from a religious standpoint, a racial standpoint, but also from the standpoint of the land inheritance, the boundary markers. Ezra understood it. And let me tell you, we need to as well. America needs to wake up, because your religion and your land, our land, is being stolen from us like it's never been stolen before. We need some leaders like Ezra and Nehemiah to stand up and start preaching on this once again, just like they did for the very same reasons they did. And again, there's nothing new under the sun. We are again losing our heritage to foreign immigrants and the children from children born from mixed relationships. But of course, there's hardly a church today that will address the issues of integration and miscegenation today. And instead, many of them are even promoting integration and even miscegenation now. And that's because most preachers are more concerned with full pews and lots of pewing, or another way to say the same thing is putrefying. Salt that's lost its savor is good for nothing. It putrefies. It's good for nothing and it'd be trampled under the foot of men. And most preachers are more interested in full pews and big churches than they are in being true to Yahweh and His Word. And that's a fact of the situation. They wouldn't dare touch this because there's going to be a whole lot of people that they're going to lose in their church if they do. And that's what they're too often concerned about. The priest rule on their own authority, and the people love to have it so. For a while. But it will come back, and it will be different someday. Now, let's return to Isaiah chapter 5. Isaiah chapter 5 and verse 8 again. Isaiah chapter 5, verse 8. Again, it says, "Woe unto them that join house to house, that lay field to field, till there be no place, that they may be placed alone in the midst of the earth." Isaiah 45 and verse 8 forbids urban housing and rural farm conglomerates or cartels, except on a temporary basis. They could lease. Those lands could be leased by someone until the year of Jubilee. But it forbids otherwise urban housing and rural farm conglomerates or cartels, and therefore one man or group of men, for that matter, were forbidden to buy up all the adjacent land or houses to their situation or wherever it might be. And once again, I would say that Ted Turner's got some answering to do before Yahweh, and so do a whole lot of other people who are essentially doing the same thing. In fact, there's hardly anybody today who wouldn't like to be doing what Ted Turner's doing, if the truth be known. Oh, they'll ridicule him, but they would love to be in his shoes to be able to do so as well. That's, again, evidence of how far we have gotten away from Yahweh's laws. The principle of Isaiah 5:8 would also apply to unlawful monopolies of any kind, with the emphasis on the word unlawful monopoly. And I emphasize unlawful monopolies because a monopoly is a single owner or seller of something, right? And we see monopolies. Monopolies, according to Isaiah 5:8 and being a part of Deuteronomy 19:14, is wrong. Well, only if it's an unlawful monopoly, because to be a single owner or seller is in itself not necessarily wrong or evil. I may have developed, for an example, a product that no one else either will or has yet duplicated. And to be the sole provider of that product, I'm not so sure Bill Gates didn't fit into this, even though they tried to, use United States monopoly laws against him. Whether you like Bill Gates, and I know a lot of people don't, but I don't think that was, in my recollection, because this is just coming back to mind now, I don't think that he was a legitimate monopoly. He had just done what others had never done yet, and had the market kind of cornered because of that. In fact, I'm sure he wasn't an unlawful monopoly. To be a single owner or seller of something doesn't necessarily make it evil. Let me read to you, and it will help rather than me trying to explain it. Let me read to you from a website entitled capitalism.org that deals with monopolies. Under the heading, Are not all monopolies harmful? The author wrote this. He said, "Being a single seller by itself is not good nor evil. It depends on how one obtained that single seller status. Did one obtain a monopoly by economic competition in the marketplace, or did one obtain it by political pull, that is, lobbying?" And that's where I think that Bill Gates, in his corner in the market, he gained it, I believe, by economic competition, not by any political pull that I'm aware of anyway. "If such status is gained by competition in the free market, then the monopoly, quote-unquote, the successful business, is good. If such status is gained by using the government or mafia to force one's competition out of business, then the monopoly is evil." Interesting how government mafia was used in the same fashion there. as all political intervention, initiation of force in the marketplace is outlawed under capitalism, a harmful monopoly under capitalism is impossible. If one considers a monopoly by definition as intrinsically evil, then only quote-unquote businesses that obtain their market share by having their competition outlawed, as the United States Post Office does, can be called a monopoly. Under the heading, how does one judge a monopoly or a non-monopoly? Observe what is evil here, the act of using the government to outlaw one's competition. It does not matter whether the government uses its power to outlaw competition to protect a single business or to benefit a group of 100 companies from a single superior competitor. Whenever the government outlaws an individual from entering and competing in any given industry, it is evil and wrong. The criterion of judgment is competition, the freedom to produce and trade, outlawed in some respect that is regulated or not? And then finally, under the heading, how are all harmful monopolies created? The sole source of harmful monopolies is the government, although it would seem that the mafia has done that as well. But he says the sole source of harmful monopolies is the government, which is the only agency that has the power to physically force competitors out of business. That is, it is the only agency that has the power to outlaw, that is, regulate competition. As evidence, witness the United States Post Office, which makes it illegal for anyone to charge less than, and they originally had written this back when it was 34 cents, it's now 37, for first-class mail. One entrepreneur attempted to compete by charging 5 cents. He did not get far. Other examples include the East India Company of the 17th and 18th century, the American Pacific Railroads of the 19th century, and the AMA's monopoly over prescription of medicine in the 20th century, end of quote. So those are just some examples provided there. Hopefully some information on monopolies that you may not have known before. But I thought that companies like Walmart and Kmart and Target, etc., were monopolies, someone may comment. Well, so did I. I had fallen for the same lie until I became better acquainted with what monopolies are. Now think about it. If Walmart, Kmart, or Target were monopolies, then there would be no Walmart, Kmarts, or Targets. There would only be a Walmart, you know, Walmart as a corporation, wherever they find themselves, a Kmart, or a Target. I think Kmart was the first, weren't they? Before Walmart came along, I'm pretty sure that they were. They would only be a Kmart if Kmarts were a monopoly. There would just be one, not all three. The very word determines that. Instead, Walmart, Kmart, and Target are fierce competitors, are they not? And therefore, they do not qualify as a monopoly because monopolies have no competitors. Furthermore, if they were monopolies, others would not be allowed to open similar businesses sometime in the future. And yet that door has not closed. And therefore, Walmart, Kmart's, the big conglomerates. See, there has been this tendency to teach us that if they're a big conglomerate, Bill Gates, you know, or whoever it is, that they've got to be a monopoly. And they just don't fit the bill. Furthermore, if they... But those are not monopolies. But those that are indeed true monopolies, as is the U.S. Postal Service, are, or at least should be, prohibited by the principle in Isaiah chapter 5 and 8, and therefore Deuteronomy 19:14, and therefore Exodus 20:15, thou shalt not steal. Because legalized monopolies are a means by which others are discriminated against, restricted, and even banned from making a lawful living through the same means as a chosen few. What's another word for chosen, biblically speaking? The elect. The elect chosen, in this case, by the government, who says only these people get to make their living by this means. And therefore, what might have been their means of living or livelihood is stolen from them. Now, it hasn't been stolen from them, but it would be. It has been stolen. What might have been, I should emphasize again, has been stolen from them. And therefore, monopolies are a true monopolies are a transgression of the Eighth Commandment. All right, let's look at another Eighth Commandment statute before we finish this message. Let's look to Leviticus 19. We may not get through all of this one. And this may be the last statute, particular statute that we'll deal with in this series. But Leviticus 19 and verses 35 and 36. Verse 35, it says, "You shall do no unrighteousness in judgment, in meat yard, in weight, or in measure. Just balances, just weights, a just ephah, and a just hin shall ye have. I am Yahweh your God, which brought you out of the land of Egypt." This, of course, is the mandate for just, or another better word probably for us, is equitable weights and measures. It's the statute that the Department of Commerce is, or at least should be, based upon. However, let me assure you, and you surely already know this, that there is much with the Department of Commerce today, both as it concerns domestic and foreign trade, that's far, far from equitable, or that could be described as just weights and measures. Verse 35 that we just read declares that we are to do no unrighteousness or do no wrong in meat yard, weight, or measures. And let me just describe those again for this particular message, especially since we're dealing King James here. Two of those are pretty evident. But the first one, what's this meat yard thing? Well, meat yard is a reference to any surface measurement. For example, a cubit or a span in those days, or of course in our days it could be a yard or a foot or inches or acreage or whatever else it might be that would be related to surface measurement. The next one was in weight, that we were to be just in all of our measurements of weight. Of course, that would be anything weighed. For example, a talent it uses, or a shekel. Now that's interesting. Of course, we could talk pounds or ounces. Of course, think of what is a pound over in England. What's a shekel and a talent? Back in those days, there was to be this weight. It was talking about money, and of course other things as well, anything that had to do with weight. But it used, more often than not, when talking about weight, it used money as an example. Unlike our money today, money then, under just weights and measures, had to have weight because they had to have substance. And I said, yes, I said, unlike our money today. And somebody says, well, there's still substance and weight to our money, our paper money, isn't there? I mean, it may not be much, but you can weigh it. And there's a substance there. It's at least paper. You know, we haven't gone to a debit system totally yet. But that's only part of the point, isn't it? Yeah, there isn't much there. But what's interesting is here is a $1 bill, and most of you know this. But there's a lot of people who don't. But you take a $1 beer and you put it alongside of or in front of a $20 bill, and well, lo and behold, now that you put the one in front of the 20, I can't see the 20 because they're the exact size and weight. And then I could take a $50 bill, which if it's really a just and equitable measure of money, then the $50 bill should be bigger than the $20 bill. If I place it behind the $20 bill and the $1 bill, I can still only see the $1 bill. Or if I take a $100 bill and put it behind the $50 and the $20 and the, if I had a $10 and a $5, which I didn't in my pocket, I could have done it with all of those, of course, as well. And they all disappear when you put it behind the $1 bill because there is no... It says one here and 20 here and 50 here, but what's to make me believe that this 100 is more valuable than the one, since if I put the one in front of the 100 disappears because they're the exact same size and the exact same weight. There is no equity between an our money, whereas you go back further enough, even in America, the coins, as they grew in denominations, got heavier in weight, either silver or gold, because they once had substance or weight to them. No longer the case today because, well, we'll talk about that more as we go on here. verse 19 talked about a measure. What were they talking about when it comes to a measure? They talked about the meat yard. They talked about the weight. And now the measure. Well, a measure was any capacity of measurement, such as an ephah was the description of a dry measurement, be comparable to our bushel, for example. Or a hin, it used the word hin. What's a hin? Well, a hin was a liquid measurement. And it was a standard. They had a standard measurement for the hin, and they had a standard measurement for the ephah. It was and whether it be dry or liquid measurement, they had a standard. New American Standard is a little bit better, a little bit more clear. In verses 35 and 36, it says, "You shall do no wrong in judgment in measurement of weight or capacity. You shall have just balances, just weights, a just ephah and a just hin. I am Yahweh your God," so forth and so on. Now, as Paul, I mean, in other words, in this passage is saying everything, there is to be a standard that everybody can count on. So that there is a just, a equitable system of economics in trade, in transaction for everyone. Paul summed up this statute very simply in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 and verse 6. He said that no man go beyond and defraud his brother in any matter. Period. It covers it all. There is that statute right there in Paul's statement. Because that the Lord is the avenger of all such, and we also have forewarned you and testified. Now, let's consider some of the ways. And I want you to maybe put your thinking caps on here and help me, because I'd like some more ideas on this, if we can come up with them. But let's consider some of the ways in which this statute concerning just weights and measures are transgressed today. Again, if you've got some ideas on this. This is happening so wide scale today in so many different ways, and we have grown used to it, and it's happening all around us, and sometimes we don't even realize it. Here's one that I came up with the help of Linda. Take a gallon of juice today. It's labeled a gallon of juice. Let me tell you, you're lucky if you can find 10% juice in that gallon. Now, it's a gallon of liquid, but it's not a gallon of juice. It's a gallon of juice and a whole lot of water and whatever else they added to it. They've just become slicker. They no longer can change a gallon, but they can change what is in the gallon and how they advertise it. How about fruit itself? This is something that sometimes is done. Sometimes fruit itself is purposely watered just prior to going to market, providing a false weight and a dilution or less flavor in the taste. You ever notice you can't buy carrots anymore hardly? Even organic carrots that have the flavor of when I was a child when we used to grow our own carrots. Something's happened to their carrots, and that's another story. A lot of it's our farming practices as well. Cattle are sometimes fed salted feed just prior to going to market so that they'll drink heavily and increase their weight. That's a transgression of just weights and measures. It's deceptive. Have you ever noticed that summer gas prices always go up? I wonder why that is. Now, we may use more, because of travel, more gas during the summer months. But it doesn't matter whether there's a whole lot of gas available or not. Come summer, the prices are going to be jacked up. It's called price gouging, and it is a transgression of this statute. Here's another one. Last time I was at the airport, going to Indiana or going to Wisconsin, I hadn't eaten all day. We got delayed as usual, and I was looking for something to eat. Have you ever bought anything in an airport? You talk about I mean, they've got a captive audience. You want to buy? I mean, I wish I meant to keep the amount that I paid for some whatever it was. Or how about popcorn prices at theaters or a ball game? You know, if it's worth so much out here, then what is there, special air in the theater that it's worth three times or four times as much in the theater? You know, that's against the law of just weights and measures. Anybody else have any ideas? Other things that are transgressions in this day and age? How bought potato chips lately? You ever notice how big those sacks are? Then you get them open, it goes, and half the potato chips disappear. Unless you're buying Pringles. You know, Pringles get them right up there. But with Pringles, you're lucky if you get any potatoes. How about insurance companies? You think insurance companies have contributed in just about everywhere to inflated prices on almost everything? It's a breaking of God's laws of just weights and measures. Anything else anybody can think of? Boy, you guys are lots of help. Again, I think we struggle with that because it is around us everywhere. And we just have grown used to it. Turn to Deuteronomy chapter 25, another passage on this. Deuteronomy 25, 13 and 14, it says, "Thou shalt not have in thy bag divers weights, a difference in weights, a great and a small, or a heavy and a light. Thou shalt not have in thine house divers measures, a great and a small." In other words, what God was condemning was the heavier to buy with. You know, they'd carry a weight around and they'd go to the scales and they'd put the wheat on one side and they'd put their weights. The heavier to buy with, because if you had the heavier and it had to balance out, you could get more wheat on the balance side with a heavier weight or a lighter to sell with. They wouldn't get as much if you were the one that had the weight on the lighter side. verses continuing with this, verses 15 and 16. "But thou shalt have a perfect and a just weight. A perfect and just measure shalt thou have, that thy days may be lengthened in the land which Yahweh thy God giveth thee. For all that do such things and all that do unrighteously are an abomination unto Yahweh thy God." Now note the blessing that Yahweh promises to those who are diligent to maintain just weights and measures, whether it be an individual or whether it be a nation. That is equity, who are diligent to maintain equity in all of their transactions and interactions with others. Yahweh declares that our days, individually or as a nation, in the land will be lengthened. The antithesis to that being that the life of a person or a nation whose general policies concerning trade and commerce violate Yahweh's laws of just weights and measures. Or another way to say that is that from a national perspective, that they'll lose control of their nation. Instead of being lengthened, it'll be shortened from what it would have been otherwise. Not only because, this takes us back a little bit, because not only will they lose control of their nation, not only because of integration and miscegenation, as we talked about before, but because of their trade practices as well. In fact, which may very well be one of the reasons why we are being invaded and taken over both by quote-unquote legal and illegal immigrants in this land today. Isn't that one of the curses that God said would happen to us for our disobedience listed in Deuteronomy 28? That He'd send them in. We'd become integrated because we were disobeying Him in other areas. In this case, God says, you don't have fair trade practices amongst your people, and I'll shorten your control over the land. Speaking of immigration, I know you've heard this before because I read it to you once before, and you've probably seen it on the internet because it's been floating around for a long time. But speaking of immigration, one guy put it this way. He says, "Is it just me, or does anyone else find it amazing that our government can track a cow, the one that had mad cow disease, born in Canada almost 3 years ago, right to the stall where she sleeps in the state of Washington. Also, they track her calves to their stalls, but they are unable to locate 11 million illegal aliens running around this country. Amazing." He came up with a solution. He said the solution is to give every illegal alien a cow. They'll find the cow, they'll find the illegal alien. Well, the truth is, back to what we were talking about, we already have lost control of this country. Besides our immigration policies, America, lock, stock, and barrel, is in hock today to the international bakers. And each and every child that is born as a citizen of the United States of America today is already in debt at the moment of their birth. Who do you think is going to pay or be responsible tomorrow for today's debt and interest? You ever seen one of those debt clocks in New York City they've got up there? That thing's spinning so fast you can't keep up with it. They're getting as much as they can out of us now. But there's no way that this generation who's living right now, that we're going to be able to take care of that debt continuing at the pace it is, or even if it was to stop right now. And therefore, it's going to be our children. They're already in hock to the international bankers. Whereas once America was the greatest lending nation of this world, one of the blessings of Deuteronomy 28 for obedience, we are now the greatest debtor nation in the world. One of the curses of Deuteronomy 28. And one of the reasons that America is the greatest debtor nation is because anyone who has looked into it in any detail whatsoever knows just how inequitable America's monetary system is. From the Federal Reserve System, which is, of course, not federal at all if you've looked into that, but is a privately owned corporation of international bankers. The whole system is inequitable, from the Federal Reserve to our fractional banking, fractional reserve banking, to our whole tax system, to the local quote-unquote friendly downtown banker, to every merchant who likewise sells their merchandise on time or with interest, or who debase their product and therefore represent it as something it is not. Now, normally we think of debasement in terms of money or coinage, but any product or merchandise bartered or sold can be debased, can it not? And I shared some of this in the economic series we did a year ago, so ago. But for example, gold watches that are no longer gold. You know that one time gold watches actually used to be gold. Try to find one today, or if you do, you're going to pay through the nose to get it. Silk ties that are no longer silk. Cotton shirts that are no longer cotton. Butter. Go ask for butter in a restaurant. And who knows what you're going to get. I mean, you have to tell them, I want butter. And still half of the waitresses won't know what you're talking about. They'll still bring you margarine or something, some substitute. Butter that's no longer butter. Brass bands that are no longer, well, the brass bands are still brass. But you get the point. Nearly everything in our quote-unquote modern society has been debased. A synonym, by the way, for debased is adulterated. It's been adulterated. It's been mixed. Cotton shirts. You think a cotton shirt, you can find a cotton shirt that's all cotton anymore? That's maybe 55% cotton, and thus they call it cotton. But the rest is synthetics, whatever that is, another mixture of who knows what, or other things. A large portion of the problem goes back to the fact that our government has defrauded and debased our money, and we are victims ourselves of the trickle-down effect, because it started with our government debasing the money. Now, that, by the way, doesn't, or not that individual merchants aren't nonetheless still responsible before God for whatever they do, but nevertheless, because the Federal Reserve is not federal, and our money is no longer money. Now, when you understand the definition of what money is, money must have weight and substance, and it must be different for different denominations. Because the Federal Reserve is not federal, and because our money is no longer money, therefore our gold watches are no longer gold, our silk ties are no longer silk, and our cotton shirts are no longer cotton. And it's no laughing matter, let me assure you. I mean, we live with it. No, we really give it a whole lot of thought, do we? All will complain now and then. But this is serious, because inequity in many different forms has been at least a part or the cause of the downfall of every former great civilization that has ever been on the face of this earth prior to, beginning with the Tower of Babel, and Babylon itself, Rome, etc., etc. And I assure you, such will also be part and parcel one day of our undoing, the ruin, the destruction of the United States of America as well, if we don't put a stop to it. Now, as for the present economy, for those who think that, you know, things are pretty peachy. You know, they've got the slaves pretty happy, don't they? Things aren't all that bad. But as for the present economy, you know, the feds, quote-unquote feds, keep pulling rabbits out of their hats, and thereby are somehow also able to keep this unscrupulous, crooked, dishonest, corrupt system afloat. But one of these days, they're going to reach in their hats, and they're going to find no more rabbits to pull out. Or better put, the time is coming when they will discover that the people have figured out that there are no rabbits, and never have been. And that it's all been by the sleight of hand or the stroke of a pen. And there weren't any rabbits to begin with. You know, at least the magician comes up with a real rabbit, even if it never was in the hat. At least he had a real rabbit. Our whole system is based upon faith. And has been for some time. And therefore, it's really a religious, our whole economic system is religious, or it's a faith system, if you want to look at it that way. In the past, at least the Federal Reserve notes, and we need to get back to gold and silver, is really what we need to get back to, but at least in the past, the Federal Reserve notes were backed with a promise to pay in gold or silver, in real rabbits. You know, real money, money of substance. But now there's nothing, absolutely nothing backing those dollars. No promise, not even a promise to pay. Nothing whatsoever. No gold, no silver, not even a promise to pay in anything. Nobody knows it, but it doesn't matter. Better that they don't know it, because then they'll believe there's actually something there. The only thing that keeps this fraudulent system afloat is the people's faith that the Federal Reserve notes they carry in their pockets are actually worth something. And nobody wants to tell them different, because as long as they believe, they'll keep trading them like they are. That they're actually worth more than the paper that they've been printed on. That's it. That's the whole system is based upon that. And when the populace finally figures out, and someday they will, that the rabbits aren't real, the system's going bust, and we will find out that we have been sold lock, stock, and barrel to the international bankers. Now, I don't have time to go there, but there's several other passages that you could look at in regards to the just weights and measures. Proverbs chapter 11 and verse 1, 16 and verse 11, Proverbs 20, 10 and 23. Those four Proverbs talk about how the just weights and measures are Yahweh, and anything else is an absolute abomination to Him. It's no trivial matter with Yahweh, whether it is with us or not. Because God describes it as an abomination. You can see that Micah deals with the same thing in Micah chapter 6, verses 1 and 2, or at least begins to deal with it, and then it's particularly in verses 8 through 15, essentially where God says, if you defraud your brother, that I will, quote, unquote, defraud you. If you want to put it in those terms. In other words, he says, as you have measured out to your brethren, I will measure out to you, whether caught or undetected by your fellow man or not, unjust weights and measures, I assure you, either way, whether detected or not detected by your brethren, will be dealt with by Yahweh. And it will not be pretty when He does. Christians, instead, and sometimes I think we can get caught up in this system. And some people say, well, if you even use dollar bills and so forth, well, we're under that system. You know, we're under that system, and they haven't given us an alternative until then. We're not doing it with intent. But sometimes we can get caught up in this unjust system of unjust, inequitable weights and measures and not even realizing we're doing it. It becomes so commonplace to take your brother that sometimes we don't even think about it when we're doing it. For the Christian, we should be living instead by Yahweh's laws. A Christian who is living, I should say, by Yahweh's laws should instead live their lives like David declared in Psalms 15, 1 through 4. And there's several things here, but it's the last thing in particular I want to note, where he says, Yahweh, who may abide in thy tent, and who may dwell on thy holy hill? You want to abide in his tent? You want to be on his holy hill, as he describes it there? then you better listen up. He says, he who walks with integrity and works righteousness, and who speaks truth in his heart, he does not slander with his tongue, nor does evil to his neighbor, nor takes up a reproach against his friend, in whose eyes a reprobate is despised, and who honors those who fear Yahweh. And then it ends by saying, and he swears to his own hurt and does not change. A man who would rather be taken than take his fellow man. Like Jacob did when Laban attempted to defraud him, if you remember the case in Genesis 31, 36 through 42. In his justification for finally leaving Laban, at one point he said, that which was torn of beast, of Laban's, he said, I did not bring it to you. I bore the loss of it myself. While Laban himself was defrauding Jacob. He could have justified it and said, well, he's defrauding me. The very least I can do is, you know, take advantage of him wherever I can. And Laban wouldn't do it. Better to be defrauded than to defraud someone yourself. May Yahweh help us to be guided by this principle, that in all of our transactions and all of our interactions with each other and our brethren as a whole, that we be found using only just, equitable weights and measures in all of our transactions. Let it be so. We'll deal with a little bit more in this series before we conclude. But again, I hope you can see that there is indeed much more to this commandment than originally meets the eyes, and much more that probably ever thought that needs to be applied to our nation to bring us back to where God intends us to be under His laws, His perfect laws, His statutes, commandments, statutes, and judgments. All right, let's stand and we'll close this in prayer. Our Heavenly Father, we are thankful to You now. Glorify You for Your Word and Your laws that are perfect. And ask that, Father, our people would be awakened, especially the churches, Lord. If we could return them to You and Your laws, we could return this nation to the kingdom You intended it to be. Guide us and direct us. Forgive us for our sins and bring us back to You and Your Word. We ask it and You will be shortened.